The following is a rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in February of 2016. This is a Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, a talk by David Fidler, who's an adjunct senior fellow for cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations. Fidler spoke about some of the emerging threats to our security in our interconnected world of the internet at a personal, individual level and at the national level. Fidler's an expert in international law, cybersecurity, national security, counterinsurgency, biosecurity, and global health. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University and an associate fellow with the Center on Global Health Security at Chatham House. And on the program today, Fidler talks about the early expectations of the internet versus its actual development with respect to security and privacy and as a tool for stimulating democracy. What's been unforeseen, Fidler argues, is how the internet has fostered large-scale cyber espionage. He examines cybersecurity at the individual state level and at the international system levels. A quick note that Fidler's talk is a bit academic in the beginning, but he touches on some very timely and provocative questions. For example, how should we balance the so-called Internet of Things when it comes to protecting our national security versus our privacy? Or how vulnerable are we to aggressive cyber theft and/or cyber terrorism from malicious foreign hackers? And how will the threat of hacking influence development of e-commerce and the integration of the internet into everything we do? Again, this talk by David Fidler was recorded in front of an audience of students and faculty at the University of Utah on February 16th, 2016. Here's David Fidler.
I'm old enough to remember those early heady days when the internet, first appeared in my office, and remembering my amazement at sending a first email and doing the first internet search and having real-time conversations in this new electronic format with colleagues all over the world. And it was at that time when there was a lot of optimism and excitement about this new technological platform coming on stream. And that excitement was really connected with different, at different levels, right? The level of the individual and what it made possible for us to do in terms of our work and our communication, for governments, for the international system. And one of the iconic documents that comes from this early period was written by John Perry Barlow. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Declaration on the Independence of Cyberspace. But it was in this document that Barlow tried to capture that sense of what the internet and what cyberspace could politically be. Not technologically, but politically, it could be. The other screenshot here is a brand new book. It's going to be released next week by Adam Siegel, who's one of my colleagues at the Council on Foreign Relations. As you can see from the title, the perspective is very different, right? Rather than this sort of new world, this new world order that John Perry Barlow and others at the beginning of the global dissemination of the internet and the beginning of cyberspace, right? Adam Siegel, and he's not alone in this context, right? His phrase for this is not a new world order, but a hacked world order. A very different understanding or perspective of what cyberspace has become and what's happened to this, the possibilities that once upon a time people associated with the political impact that the internet and cyberspace might have in this context. And so it's that trajectory that I want to try to explain. What's happened, right? How did we end up at this particular point in time? And what I want to try to do, perhaps strangely, is reach back to an analytical framework that's pre-cyber, right? And I don't know if you're at all familiar with Kenneth Waltz's famous book, Man, the State, and War. And here's where I have to make apologies to the political science, the scientists that might be in the room, and apologies to Kenneth Waltz for taking liberties with this framework. But I've used this with students, and I've used it in some of the talks that I give on this, and it seems to have resonated well with audiences, so I thought I might take it out for a bit more of a spin here. Obviously, Kenneth Waltz wasn't talking about cyberspace and the internet, right? This came out in the late 1950s. But what he did was the book was a study about the causes of war. And he looked at the causes of war according to what he thought were three images that he saw in international relations literature. What he called the first, the second, and the third image. Right? The first image, cause of war, is caused by human nature, sort of focus at the individual level. The second image was the explanations or the arguments that war arises because of the nature of governments. So focus on the state level. Or the third image, cause of war, was the anarchical international system. So it wasn't human nature, it wasn't whether you're a democracy or a dictatorship. It was the structure of anarchy and the way in which anarchy related to the behavior of states that was the cause of war. These three images developed into international relations thinking in broader ways, particularly sort of the levels of analysis, right? So when we're going to break down and look at different types of phenomenon in international relations, often you still see these levels of analysis being used. And that's what I'm going to try to do to explain this trajectory from those early days of the internet and cyberspace to where we find ourselves today. It's a little cheeky, right? It's a little, I'm skating on some thin ice in terms of using it in the way that I'm going to do. But with that caveat, let me try to unfold what I'm trying to do in connection with using this particular framework. And so we saw a lot of discussion, a lot of belief that cyberspace and the internet was going to be very positive for, at the individual level, it was going to empower individuals, and it was going to enhance individual liberty. And so the access to this type of technology was really going to have an impact at that level. At the state level, right, if we've got empowered individuals, enhanced individual liberty, that's going to put limitations on state power, and is going to support democratic forms of government and the global spread of democracy at the same time. Those two combined together were then anticipated to have an impact at the third image, or the international system level. So we get cyber-enhanced human rights that are happening on a global basis. The internet and the interconnectedness that comes with this new technology is going to increase interdependence, not just economic interdependence, but all kinds of interdependence in the system through this new communications platform. And human rights and interdependence would feed into, right, possibilities for democratic peace, right? And this connected to the democratic peace thesis that was prominent in those years as well. So what we have in connection with these levels of analysis, right, the impact at the individual level of the first image and the impact at the state level were going to produce changes at the third image level. It was going to change the nature of international relations and international politics. And so we were getting cyber-enabled peace, right, or moving closer to peace through these new types of technology. So you can, I'm trying to use these images to plot a dynamic about what people were talking about at the time. Now, again, this obviously wasn't evidence-based because these things were just coming on stream, right? We didn't have any evidence with regards to this particular types of information technologies. Also keep in mind that at this time, right, 20 years ago, post-Cold War period, right, there was all kinds of discussion and excitement about the spaces that had been opened up after the end of the Cold War for human rights. There was lots of excitement about new possibilities with interdependence, right? This is the World Trade Organization comes along right at about the same time these phenomenon with the internet and cyberspace begin to happen. We have lots of conversation outside of the cyber context about the spread of democracy and the importance of democracy in the international system. Right? And that's when the democratic peace thesis was also gaining traction. So to some extent, it's not a surprise that we would see the cyber discussion mirroring conversations that were happening on lots of different issues in international relations at this time. Right? But the idea here was that cyberspace was going to be something different. Cyberspace was going to have a political impact that would be greater than any previous information or communication technology, and particularly combining first and second image impacts in changing the nature of international relations. That was at least the nature of the conversation at that time. Okay, well, fast forward, right, to where we are today, right? And it's a very different picture. And again, we can use this analytical framework to sort of plot out what might be happening in regards to this situation. And I think we really have to sort of reverse how we begin to look at this, because this is what seems to be happening. We have a very different picture at the third image, or the international system level now. We haven't achieved cyber-enabled peace. In fact, what we're seeing more and more at that third image, anarchical system level, on the cyber side, is states engaging in large-scale cyber espionage. Okay. We got a glimpse of that through disclosures that Edward Snowden made. We learn more about the espionage practices of other countries towards the United States. But this is happening on a very large, and some would argue an unprecedented scale. We've never seen spying on this scale before, facilitated by the internet and cyberspace. And secondly, we're seeing lots of countries, not just the great powers, but other regional powers, and other countries worried about the great powers and regional powers, getting very interested in developing capabilities to engage in cyber conflict and cyber war. And so we're beginning to see not only the development of specific cyber warfare capabilities, but we're beginning to see militaries designing ways to integrate cyber warfare capabilities into all kinds of military campaigns. So we're seeing the integration of cyber weapons and cyber capabilities in that context as well. At the state level, non-democratic governments have proved a lot more resilient with regards to cyberspace than was the expectation, right, in those early days. In fact, many authoritarian countries have proved quite adept at both increasing the levels of internet access of their populations and at the same time increasing the level of control and censorship over their citizenry's use of these technologies. And this, again, was not anticipated back in the day, right? This has been something that was not foreseen from the point of view of the impact of these technologies at the level of the state. I haven't got it on this slide, but we've also had the unanticipated consequence that democracies have struggled far more with these technologies than was anticipated at the time. I'll come back to some of that later. We've struggled with the relationship between these technologies and our ideas of human rights, civil and political rights, for example. These two contexts, right, change in geopolitics, the ideological conflict that we have between authoritarian and democratic governments over cyberspace and what's happening with the internet, these are feeding into risks, cyber insecurity at the individual level, where individuals in their use of the internet, in their use of cyberspace, are vulnerable today in ways that they have never been before. And they're vulnerable not just to states, right, which I've mainly been talking about here, but they're also vulnerable to criminal organizations and cybercrime, or they're vulnerable to terrorist groups exploiting the internet and social media. Right. So at the first image level, we have a lot of vulnerability and a lot of risk driven by the political dynamics that we see at the international system level and then at the state level. And that's produced this enormous cyber insecurity that we see today. Very different. This is the hacked world order that Adam Siegel is talking about in his book. And so because of the development of this level of cyber insecurity at the first, second, and third image levels, I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about cybersecurity policy. Back in the day, we didn't talk a lot about cybersecurity. Now it's all about cybersecurity. Right? Cybersecurity is everywhere. And so trying to understand what's going on in the evolution of policy on cybersecurity becomes particularly important when we understand sort of the change of trajectory of this going forward.
That's David Fidler. He's an adjunct senior fellow for cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations and teaches law at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. And if you're just joining us today, it's a rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in February of 2016. You were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them mostly unedited as a public service to you. In this hour, we are airing a talk given back in February of 2016 by David Fidler, who writes, teaches, and does research on cybersecurity. Fidler analyzed our emerging understanding of cyber threats and the development of cyber defense at the individual domestic levels and at a national foreign policy level. Here's David Fidler.
When we first started down the road of thinking about cybersecurity, the main approach to this was what I call the cyber threat approach, and that really involves two pieces. The first is we were going to look at a cyber incident, and then we were going to classify that according to pre-existing categories that we took from national security. So here's a cyber incident. Is it crime? Is it terrorism? Is it espionage? Or is it war, right? And we would, once we had classified it, then we have policy prescriptions and rules of domestic and international law that apply to crime, terrorism, espionage, and war, right? So we would put it in the box, apply the policy prescriptions, and apply the rules that we had that fit that particular category. All right, and that was the idea. That began to be criticized as cyber incidents began to grow not only in volume, but also in terms of their consequences. And the criticisms leveled at this cyber threat approach were that first it's really entirely reactive, right? A cyber event happens, then I categorize, and then I apply. It's not doing anything to protect our systems from these infiltrations, right? Second criticism of the cyber threat approach was, except for the development of specific rules domestically and internationally on cybercrime, the rules that we had for terrorism, espionage, and armed conflict were all legacy rules. In other words, we were applying rules developed before cyber came along and then just trying to apply them to the cyber consequences. And people didn't think that these legacy rules gave us enough traction to deal with the fundamentally different nature of the problem. So we began to get more interest in protecting, right, our systems from these. That led to an increased interest in cyber defense. And what I mean by cyber defense is this is what's thought of as an all-hazards approach. In other words, I don't need to know whether it's a criminal, a terrorist, a spy, or a foreign soldier that's trying to get into my system. There are things I can do to keep out threats no matter what the source is. So it's a very different approach to this. So people begin to get interested in cyber defense through this all-hazards type approach. That creates a whole nother set of policy and legal issues that are not replicated at the cyber threat level, right? I don't have time to go into all of those, but it generates those sets of issues off of that. Well, people say, well, that's fine, but that doesn't get us where we need to go because it's too passive. It's passive cyber defense, right? It's not doing anything to prevent attacks from happening or prevent these very serious cyber incidents from having these negative consequences for individuals, for the state, or for international relations. And so that's when we begin to see this, again, what I'm calling cyber deterrence, develop as a policy thread. So if I want to prevent cyber, particularly serious cyber incidents or cyber attacks against my country, I'm going to try to deter my adversaries from those types of things. And in order to deter my adversaries, I need to have full spectrum capabilities. I need offensive capabilities and defensive capabilities. I cannot deter unless I have a credible way to threaten punishment and inflict punishment if you cross the line, right? And we know this from other deterrence contexts. A question that's coming up in connection with this is, do those previous understandings of deterrence theory and practice work with cyber, right? We're watching this unfold now. We're present at creation, if you will, with regards to this issue. But also, if I do then get into a cyber conflict with an adversary, I have not deterred them. I need, again, full spectrum capabilities to defeat that adversary in that conflict. Right? And so that's the third level, the cyber deterrence approach. Now, again, all of these are still active today as part of cybersecurity policy. They overlap and they interact in ways that I don't know how to show that on a slide, right? I'm not that good at drawing these things. But even having said that, there is a clear shift in policy emphasis towards cyber deterrence. And we really saw this in 2015, right, in Washington, D.C. And this is also happening in other places around the world. That, of course, lines up with my three images analysis, right? In terms of the geopolitics, the ideological conflict between states is leading countries to be more interested in full spectrum capabilities to deter and defeat in connection with different types of armed conflict. So we have this alignment between what we're seeing in cybersecurity and what we're seeing more broadly with regards to thinking about what's happened in cyberspace. And so we end up with this sort of understanding that we've had really comprehensive change in this context, right? We've moved from these expectations early on, right, on the impact on individuals, on the state, changing the international system, and often not really looking at the underlying assumptions of these expectations. This is the sort of the cyber utopianism that people now talk about, right? An empowered liberty, democracy was the dominant. You know, democracy was the only game in town when this was being discussed. And we were really in this unipolar or unusual international system where the United States was dominant. Well, that's not what we have today, right? Again, now we've got geopolitics at the third image, ideological conflict, second image, individuals at risk. We're now in a multipolar system, right? The United States is not the only game in town. Real conflict between democracies and authoritarian governments, especially over cyberspace issues, but also in other contexts. That all is producing insecurity here at the individual level. And again, that's insecurity that's not only from these really state-centric dynamics, but that also creates the possibility for non-state actors, cybercrime and cyberterrorism, to be involved in this context. We also have to be aware, right, that this shift, this comprehensive change has happened in this way, sort of this political analysis. What I don't have here, which I'm going to talk a little bit about more tonight, are this is very fluid and very dynamic, right? And there are all sorts of things that are on the near horizon which are going to agitate the changes that we've seen and ending up over here. New waves of technological innovation are coming. Have you heard of the Internet of Things, right, as a concept, right? I mean, this is supposedly going to revolutionize the Internet. And cybersecurity people are worried that here comes a whole new wave of vulnerabilities that we're going to have because of the connection of everything to the Internet. We also have commercial enterprises around the world driving hard to grow, expand, deepen e-commerce. Right? So that's also going to factor into this in terms of taking up these new technologies and trying to commercialize them on a global basis, right? The new Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has one of the most interesting chapters on e-commerce of any international trade agreement that has yet been negotiated. That's an example of what's coming in connection with that. Third, there are efforts, particularly in connection with development policy, to get billions and billions of more people online, right? The Sustainable Development Goals is trying to do that. As we bring more and more people online, that's also going to have a political impact on these dynamics. Okay, what do we do then, right? Where are we now with this? This is going to be very high level, right? We can talk maybe about some more specific details in the question and answer period. But if I want to use this little framework one more time to sort of identify strategic targets for what we need to be thinking about in this next phase, right? This is sort of how I would I would plot this. And this, much of this is really going to relate to the United States or other democracies in terms of how we have to think about these issues. But I'm actually quite worried about what we're seeing in cyberspace, particularly the reaction of democracies to some of these developments about a lessening of commitment to civil and political rights. We actually have people talking about whether the United States needs to change our approach to the First Amendment because of the way the Islamic State exploits social media. I mean, these are serious conversations. Right? That's, I think, is a real problem, right? We've got this discussion happening at the international level as well, where pressure is being put on the United States for having too strict a reading of freedom of expression. And so other countries that want to deal with the Islamic State's exploitation of the internet and social media believe the United States is a bottleneck with regards to that problem. Privacy, right? We have all sorts of controversies within the United States about privacy in connection with cyber technologies. We have problems with our European allies about what privacy means, right? And so we have a lot of work that we have to do, I think, to try to get back to the point at which we're defending our commitment to these rights in a more robust manner. And when I say that, I don't mean that to sound dogmatic, because I think now we have some real deliberative responsibilities that this change in cyberspace has placed on us as a body politic. For me, I think the best example of that is, what are we going to do about encryption? Intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies are really worried about the impact on their responsibilities. They're part of the social contract. And I've seen this not just in the U.S. The Canadian prosecutors are worried about this, British, the French. Law enforcement officials in democratic countries are really worried about where encryption is going. But it looks as if it's becoming a zero-sum game politically, right? And that's the kind of challenge that I think we're going to have to think about with regards to the first image level. Second, we have got to get our act together with cyber defenses. Even though this is at the top of the priority list of, when you see these things from politicians, we have been very poor at this, both in the private sector and at the public sector. You probably heard, right, of the infamous hack of the Office of Personnel Management, right? That's 7 years into the Obama administration, which came into office saying that it was going to protect and defend U.S. government computer systems, right? That's embarrassing. Right, that we are still at that point in time. Things aren't that much better on the cyber defense side in the private sector. That suggests that cyber defense is a lot harder in practice than it is in theory. But that's something that I think we have to do, again, from the point of view of democracies, getting our head around that. And those two things sort of go together at the first and second image level. The third image, I think we need some digital detente. Right. We need digital detente, for example, between the United States and China. We have to acknowledge that competition between the great powers, between the United States and China, is going to continue in cyberspace and in real space. But we have to try to manage the cyber piece of this so that cyber incidents don't escalate, right, into cyber conflict or spill over into real space conflicts and tensions that we have. And also the other way, right, that as real space problems between these countries get worse, that those don't spill over and cause cyber escalation in the cyber context, right? We have to figure out a way of managing this. And what's fascinating about what we saw in 2015 was China and the United States beginning this dance, beginning to signal to each other about these issues. Again, fitting in with the cyber deterrence notion, but cyber deterrence only works if you're more transparent about what you value and what you're willing to do if they cross the line, right? China and the United States entered into an agreement to no longer pursue economic cyber espionage. Unprecedented, right? And so there are possibilities here of designing some management through this digital detente that helps stabilize the international system level, right? And so we're trying to create this sort of equilibrium between what we have to do, first and second image, and things that we can do at the international system level, right? So that's sort of the idea about strategic targets with regards to where we are now and where we might need to go, you know, in the future. And I'm happy to talk about more. I haven't given a lot of details here, but I can talk about specific things that might plug in to this little framework. But I see that I've now just gone over my 30 minutes, so I want to be quiet and let you participate in the conversation as well. At least I hope that was interesting or helpful to sort of think about the political trajectory of what we've seen in cyberspace, where we are today, and some of the really difficult questions that we face strategically, not only as a democracy, but in our relationships with our allies, and then how we interact with our adversaries and our competitors in the international system.
That's David Fidler. He teaches law at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. If you're just joining us today, it's the rebroadcast of a talk originally aired in February of 2016. And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today we are broadcasting a talk given at the Hinckley Institute of Politics back in 2016 by David Fidler. He's an adjunct senior fellow for cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations. His talk touched on threats at a personal individual level, the risk to private companies and governments, and how the risk of cyber espionage and even cyber terrorism is shaping foreign policy for the United States. In this final segment, Fidler answers questions from the audience of students.
My name is Elliot Fleming. I'm a political science major. I'm just curious if you could talk about kind of the fact that there's cybersecurity policy as far as how we respond to threats, whether it's, you know, a foreign state or a hacker or cyber crime within the U.S. has no real clear path. So when it comes in and, you know, if it goes to DOD or it goes to the FBI, there's no, you know, IT czar essentially. And it seems like there's been some reluctance inside of Congress to really create new agencies or departments specifically designed for that. And they want to integrate them in with what the existing infrastructure. So I was kind of curious what your thoughts on that are and, you know, what the future, is there really going to need to be a hard line on who decides, essentially.
Yes, and that's been part of the problem, particularly at the U.S. government level, is that we've had fragmentation, right? And this is, I mean, and this is followed, again, sort of, if you want to talk about legacy bureaucracy, right? So when cyber becomes the hot topic, everybody wants a piece of that turf. I mean, you can't, it's not just the executive branch. You know, there's, to get any cyber issue vetted by the congressional committees that say they have jurisdiction over that is a nightmare. And that then feeds back to how the executive branch has to do this. And so the Bush administration considered cyber a higher priority than the Clinton administration did, for obvious reasons, as this begins to get more and more of a problem. The Obama administration came in, cyberspace policy review, 2009, right off the bat, right, first 100 days. They said, we are going to deal with all of these. We're going to reorganize. We're going to pass legislation. Virtually none of it has happened, including at the level of getting the government's house in order. So when the OPM hack happened, right, everybody's running around blaming, have we made any progress here with regards to where does the responsibility lie with regards to that issue? It's not just that, it's the relationship of the government to the private sector, right? And there, I mean, the Snowden revelations have just really been very, very damaging for the private sector's ability to cooperate with information sharing on the cyber defense piece, right, with the federal government. That's part of what the encryption controversy is about. So at every level of this, right, we have problems that come out of fragmented bureaucracy, bad relations between the government and the private sector, and then we as individuals are all totally dependent on this, right? That's where our vulnerabilities begin, and we begin to get paranoid, right, about what we're doing online. And so I think from the strategic point of view, and this is where I have to swallow hard, because then I say, well, the next administration's going to do better with regards to this. But to some extent, as we kick the can down the road on that issue, and we wait for the next administration to do this, we have no idea right now. I don't know if you're watching the campaigns, right? I have no idea whether anybody's thinking about these strategic challenges that we are going to have to face with the next administration. But you're right. These are the kinds of things that are going to come under these strategies as things that we've got to do to implement a new strategic engagement with this problem.
My name's Justin Anderson, and I just recently finished an internship with Senator Mike Lee, and I talked to a lot of local and non-local constituents who got letters in the mail from OPM saying that their information had been hacked, and they're very upset, and a lot of their questions were...
As was my wife when she got that letter, yeah.
A lot of their questions were, how could this happen, and like what can be done to prevent it, and so I'm just kind of asking that question on their behalf, because I didn't really have a good answer, and it was... probably know better.
Well, I mean, I'm an international lawyer, right? So don't ask me to fix a computer, right? But part of the problem now is we continue to think that this is just a technological fix. It's not a technological fix. These things have to be driven by strategic policy. Why did these individuals get this letter that their information had been taken in the OPM hack? Is years and years and years and years of neglect of cyber defenses in federal government civilian computers. And that's a responsibility that falls on both the Obama administration and Congress. There's been a failure on both sides of that, right? I don't know if you saw this, right, but President Obama in his final budget, right, has proposed a 35% increase for a cybersecurity national action plan to defend federal civilian computers, right? This we should have been doing, and I've heard the cybersecurity people look at what the OPM had in terms of its cyber. It was pathetic, right? Pathetic, right? So again, our political branches have got to get their act together strategically on this and make commitments. And sometimes that might mean mandating that action, not just for the government, but maybe even for private sector entities, that we have got to scale up and improve our game in cyber defenses. It's really that simple. We just haven't done it. There's been a lot of talk, but there hasn't actually been strengthened cyber defenses to the extent we need, given the levels of vulnerabilities that the government, companies, and individuals face.
When you're talking about cyber weapons, what do you mean exactly? Like, I shows my ignorance a little bit, but I only know like about hacking and viruses and stuff like that. So other than that, what else is there in regards to cyber weapons?
Well, and this is what's interesting when we talk about weapons, right? We sort of kind of think we understand what that means. And this is where cyber experts will say cyber is different, right? Because cyber weapons are going to be composed of different pieces. And some talk about it in terms of the means and methods of cyber warfare as opposed to just talking about weapons, right? So you've heard of Stuxnet, right? Stuxnet, right? The malware that was inserted into the Iranian nuclear centrifuge facility in Natanz. Oh, okay. All right. Well, this is a cyber weapon, right? That's why I go to this, right? So allegedly, the United States and Israel developed this weapon, right? This piece of malware. People that discovered it called it Stuxnet because of information in the code. This was used to cause uranium enrichment centrifuges in Iran to spin out of control. And it physically damaged hundreds of centrifuges at this facility, right? That was a purpose-built cyber weapon used to destroy physical property in another country, right? So that's an example of perhaps one of the only examples we have of a purpose-built cyber weapon used to destroy things is what we usually associate with weapons, right? But that attack had to involve all sorts of other bits and pieces. It wasn't just the payload and the malware, right? We had to get it into the system there. They had to use what are called zero-day vulnerabilities, right? Flaws in software programs operating on these systems that we could exploit to get the malware in. So these cyber weapons involve all of these means and methods, which gets very, very complicated. Countries are beginning to develop those capabilities to have those types of means and methods for purposes of deterrence and, if necessary, for purposes of actually engaging in cyber conflict. This is the concern that people have had for a long time, that if we went down the weaponization route, we were going to militarize cyberspace. And it looks like we've reached that point, right, in this context. And so I don't know if that, you know, answers your question, but there are lots of possibilities. And part of it, too, is the nature of our vulnerabilities creates the possibility for all kinds of different weapons. And it's shrinking those vulnerabilities that might let us get a handle on what's going to happen on the cyberspace and war side of this. Now, the other aspect of this, right, on the armed conflict side of things, and this is what's partly interesting, is that if you look at the way in which the laws of armed conflict operate, and you look at the way in which at least it seems the United States, Russia, and China are thinking about these, it's actually not as gloomy as one might think. Right? If you think about the ethics of armed conflict, cyber weapons are actually a pretty attractive weapon compared to kinetic weapons. And so they might slot very nicely into the law of armed conflict. The problem with that is that provides incentives to develop those weapons. And the worry about escalation and the willingness to use them because they're less lethal than kinetic weapons, right? It's a very curious dynamic that comes out of the development of cyber weapons in terms of what we're seeing today. There's a question back here.
Well, my name's Robert. I was a software developer for cyber weapons for the Air Force for 6 years. There seems to be very clear lines on conventional weapons, what constitutes an act of war. Whereas with your presentation here, you treated it as an espionage issue largely. Is there a movement in the international community to put a clear definition on what's an act of war as far as cyber weapons?
Oh, well, let me break that into two parts. The answer to that question is yes, right? Okay. First, even before we had cyber technology, right, we had international law on the use of force. What is an act of war, right? Those rules were always difficult, right? Even before cyber came along. And so we have a difficult legacy rule applied now to a whole new type of technological capability. Where I can scale, right? I can build a piece of malware to destroy property or to do something else, right? And at what point, if I'm using cyber technologies, do I cross a line which we never clearly had drawn in the first place, right? Let's go back to Stuxnet. Was Stuxnet an act of war? Purpose-built cyber weapon allegedly used by two states against another state that physically damaged property, lots of property in that territory. If this had been, if we had used a smart weapon, right, to do that, would we be talking about whether that was an act of war? No, we wouldn't, right? That would have crossed the line. But this has been a really hard-fought question amongst international lawyers as to whether or not that was an armed attack, whether that was a use of force, whether that was an act of aggression. And the reason for that is because of the technology. The technology is different. We can do different things with it, right? So on the armed conflict side, the deterrent side, right, we're trying to figure that out as we try to figure out how to deter China from crossing certain red lines. And we don't know whether or not deterrence theory is actually going to work with these technologies yet. We're watching this unfold, right? So all of those issues on the war side, right, are alive and hotly debated everywhere. What I've noticed in talking to JAG lawyers about the law of armed conflict as it relates to cyber weapons, this for them is not a hard issue. Right? Cyber weapons can slot right easily into, right, how the U.S. looks at the law of armed conflict. That's not their challenge when they're advising the combatant commander. Those still are kinetic issues. So that's an interesting response, too, right, to all of this concern and hype we have about cyber war and cyber weapons, right? If we begin to apply some of these rules, sometimes it's a concern. Other times it looks as if at least the lawyers aren't all that exercised about it. Right? And we have to kind of figure this out as we go along.
Yes, hi. My name is Ross Chambliss. we had Ted Koppel here a couple months ago. He talked about, he recently wrote a book called Lights Out and kind of talked about the vulnerability of the United States power grid to potentially, well, one of the vulnerabilities is to hacking from an outside aggressor. And, you know, he spoke about not just knocking out the power for a few hours, but several weeks where, you know, food and water and becomes an issue for many, many people. How realistic, perhaps down the road, do you think that sort of risk of having the power grid taken out? I mean, could that become a reality, perhaps?
Well, there's technologically, yes, these things can be taken down, right? There are vulnerabilities in the systems that people can find and exploit. And one of our concerns is that our foreign governments are doing reconnaissance on our electrical grids and our critical infrastructure to find vulnerabilities so that if the time came, they could then take those systems down. Part of that is signaling, right? Part of that is the deterrence. I have the capability to do that, right? And I know you have that capability to do that to me. It's part of the signaling that's taking place here. This concern has largely arisen in two contexts. One is the context of cyber terrorism. This goes all the way back to the Clinton administration. So one of the first things the Clinton administration really worried about in this space was terrorists using cyber weapons to take down critical infrastructure, electrical grids, you know, water and sanitation systems, right? So this is, you know, back in the late 1990s, this was the top issue when they began to think about the importance of protecting critical infrastructure. What's interesting is that we haven't seen terrorist groups be that interested or capable in using cyber attacks against anything, right? The attacks that they have managed to mount, for example, when the Islamic State defaced U.S. Central Command's website, right? We couldn't even be bothered to call that cyber terrorism. That was cyber vandalism, we called it, right? It just didn't get to the level of being any type of consequence that the U.S. military was worried about. To our surprise, terrorists haven't been interested in developing cyber weapons. They've been interested in sending tweets, right? And using Facebook. And this is just really, it's bedeviling us. We just don't know how to deal with that particular problem, and it may lead us down some unfortunate paths. The second context is a government attacking our critical infrastructure. And there it sort of the conversation often goes in terms of what's possible, right? Could it be possible that China would take down the United States electrical grid? What's often missing from that is, why would China do that, right? Why, what context could possibly explain China responding in that way, right? Because that might cross a line, right? And our response is not, and we've made this absolutely clear, our response is not limited to a cyber response, right? Now you're inviting potential that's the deterrent, right? It's the deterrent from stepping across the line. And often when you have these scenarios spelled out, nobody tells you, gives you any realistic scenario about why it would happen, right? In the same way we could take down electrical grids all over, why would we do it, right? If it's in armed conflict, it's a violation of the law of armed conflict. That's attack, deliberate attack on civilian targets, right? On things that are essential to civilian well-being. So the U.S. military has no interest in taking down those systems unless they directly support military operations of the adversary. So when you begin to think about the political context in which these sorts of nightmare scenarios would have to happen, we end up somewhere else, right? We end up in a situation where both sides don't really want to cross that line, right? There's no reason why they would do that unless we escalate. So a real space conflict, U.S., China, South China Sea, that escalates into cyberspace. We need to manage that, right? Or we overreact because we think China's getting ready to take down the electrical grid on the east, and we escalate in cyber, right? We need to manage that process, right? And that's part of what's going on with this song and dance on the deterrent side. It's the same thing in terms of lots of the conversation about cyber war, right? It's a lot of hype about that. But when you actually sort of, how would this really unfold? Most people today don't think we're going to see pure cyber war. What we're going to see is militaries integrating cyber capabilities into their war fighting in the real world, right? And this is what people are talking about now with so-called hybrid war. And how Russia, for example, is using information and cyber operations as part of what it did in Crimea and what it's doing in eastern Ukraine. That's a different war-fighting problem than cyber war, right?
To follow up on your reference to China, a former United States senator has said to me that we today, the United States government, indeed has the capacity to shut down the electrical grid system all over Beijing, and could do it if, for example, there's a conflict in the Asia-Pacific area over oil or land. Today, President Obama's meeting in California with 10 countries in the Southeast Asian area, very concerned with China's behavior in the Asia Pacific. Given we have that cyber ability, Where do we draw the line? Where do we draw the line in an imagined scenario?
Right, and that drawing, the drawing of that line is not going to be determined by cyber. The drawing of that line is going to be determined in real space, in the South China Sea, right? And this is the concern, right? If we're going to see cyber conflict, many people are arguing it's going to come out of conflict in the real world. So we're thinking about it wrong if we go from cyber to real space. It's actually the other way around, right? So at what point would the United States think about using cyber attacks against civilian infrastructure in Beijing over what's happening in the South China Sea? Right? Very difficult question, right? Because at that point, are you crossing a line that we're never sure where that line is? Right? I might think that China's crossed that line, I'm justified. They're not going to think that's where the line is. We've escalated in ways that give them a green light to harm us. And it's that part of what, you know, what we've seen over the course of cyberspace and peace and war here is that once upon a time we thought cyberspace was going to change real space politics. Actually, real space politics has just absorbed cyberspace, right? And it's those conflicts that are going to decide the outcome of this. Think about the Islamic State. What gives the Islamic State its power, right? Its appeal. It's not the fact that they can sit around and tweet. It's the fact that they have territory, right? They control territory. That's the source of their power. We're going to have this problem in cyberspace with the Islamic State until that problem is dealt with, right? And so I think we're chasing ourselves in circles and potentially damaging our commitment to civil and political rights by thinking that we can control or censor cyberspace and that will have a strategic impact on the Islamic State. No, right? That's a boots on the ground, not a bites on the net problem, right? And so we're present at creation. I don't know that anybody has an answer to your question, right? We're having to sort of think through how does cyber come into a real space conflict? That's certainly not what we started thinking about 20 years ago, but that's the point we've reached now. And that goes into this internet, the management of those issues between China and the United States. We are going to compete, we are going to be in conflict, but we need to have ways of making sure, real space and cyberspace, that we don't let this escalate. Right.
Perhaps one more question. And if we don't have any other questions, please join me in thanking our speaker for an excellent forum.
That's David Fidler. He's an adjunct senior fellow for cybersecurity at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is also a senior fellow at the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. His talk was recorded at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of University of Utah back on February 16, 2016. You can find his talk, which looks at cybersecurity and the emerging threats of the internet, as well as other Hinckley forums, at our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.